This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on this Memorial Day, the story of America's first female soldier, Deborah Sampson, who disguised herself as a man during the Revolutionary War.
When I think of Deborah, I think of her less as a person who desperately wanted to be a man, and much more as a person who desperately wanted to belong.
Also today, Orange is the New Black actress Lea Delaria. She got her start in showbiz as a jazz singer.
Pretty much till I hit puberty, and my mom kind of put herself spread eagle in front of the door and said, "You're not taking my teenage daughter into that nightclub with all those men." Of course, now she probably wishes she'd let me go.
Plus,
take these chains from my heart.
Jazz vocalist Madeline Peru pays tribute to the great Ray Charles.
He's exciting to listen to, and he's a lot of fun to listen to. But also, I think if you want to learn about music, there's a whole world that just opens up completely.
All that coming up this hour on Radio Boston.
First, this news.
This podcast is a free service of WBUR. Please help us keep it free. Go to WBUR.org and click donate in the upper right-hand corner. And now back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. On this Memorial Day, we're listening back to some conversations with some of the extraordinary people we've had on the program over the past few months. And we thought it only fitting to begin today with a story of a soldier.
At the beginning of Alex Meyer's debut novel, Revolutionary, Deborah Sampson is a 22-year-old weaver in colonial Massachusetts who yearns for something more. She tells her friend, "There is a world out there, beyond weaving, beyond housework." So she cuts her hair, disguises herself as a man, and fights against the British in the Continental Army.
The novel is based on the true story of Deborah Sampson, who's recognized as the nation's first female soldier and a hero of the American Revolution. In 1983, the Massachusetts legislature named her the official state heroine and declared May 23rd Deborah Sampson Day.
Author Alex Myers feels a special connection to Sampson. Myers is a female-to-male transgendered person and was the first openly trans student at Harvard.
We spoke to Myers last January when his novel was released, and he began by telling us about his ancestral ties that inspired him to write Revolutionary.
My grandmother was an amateur genealogist, and she loved to tell stories about our family. We used to come down for Patriots Day and see the reenactment of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, and I actually had quite a couple of ancestors who fought in the Revolutionary War. So Deborah Sampson's was just one of the stories that my grandmother told me.
So tell us a little about her life that she was leaving behind when she was enlisted. What was her life like there in 18th century Massachusetts?
She was one of seven children. Her father abandoned the family and moved up to Maine and took up with a second wife, leaving her mother alone to raise seven kids. Mm. And at the age of five or six, Deborah was put out. That's the colonial term for foster care. She was put out in the service of a widow or a spinster, and was basically that woman's servant until the woman died. And at that point, Deborah was sold into a bond, the New England term for indentured servitude. Mm-hmm. She was a bond servant to Deacon Thomas of Middleborough from age 10 to age 18. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine how hard her life was, just mm-hmm. grindingly poor. She was always looking to make extra money. She raised ducks and geese. And in 1782, she had been free from her bond for a couple of years. She was working as a weaver, an itinerant job back in those days. She would go from house to house that owned a loom and weave for them piece by piece. She taught school in the summer. She just put her jobs together as she could find them. And in 1782, there was a call for 3 years men by General Washington, and he asked for a new crop of soldiers. No one was interested. So the towns had to offer a huge amount of money in order to get soldiers to sign on, men to sign on to become soldiers. I think it was an opportunity she couldn't resist, both for the money and for the chance to truly be free.
Interesting. Now, I want to go back to your grandmother. When she first told you about Deborah Sampson, how did she present her to you? And how did that story sort of resonate with you?
I think for my grandmother Puffer, it was a story of a young woman who was so patriotic and so caught up in the spirit of the revolution that she just really wanted to serve. But what I heard when my grandmother told the story was, oh, Deborah Sampson watched all the young men of her town march off to war, and she was jealous. She wanted to be a soldier, too. And for my grandmother, that meant patriotism. But for me, that meant I looked at boys a lot when I was young and said, I want to do what they're doing.
Interesting.
And you know, it's a very different world in 1992 than it was in 1782, but I still felt that boys were allowed to do things that girls weren't, and I still felt as a young girl that I wanted to be more like them.
It's just so interesting. I mean, you know, when you think about this story and the layers of meaning in it, I mean, the American Revolution, fighting for freedom, fighting against tyranny, and then embedded in this story is this story of a woman fighting to free her own self from what? Her own body, her own, the forces of the society that she was living in. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's amazing.
Well, I did make some of it up.
Yeah, of course, because you wrote a novel. So let me ask you about that. Why a novel rather than a biography?
Well, there's just a story to it. There's a narrative arc to it that I wanted to add. You can never know somebody's psychology. You can never really know their emotions, but you can imagine that. So there was a lot of truth that was, as you say, as good as fiction or better than fiction, but I wanted to add to that. I wanted to make Deborah real. And unfortunately, we will never know. She didn't keep a diary of everything that she thought, so I got to make up in between, as well as the fact that we know the major events of her life. Yeah. We know what she tells us about her war service, but we don't know all the details. And so I was able to take what was a kind of a spinal column of events and add ligaments and muscle and flesh to those to make a story. It was a lot of fun.
There's a moment in the book where Deborah or Robert, as she calls herself, and another soldier, Jeremiah, are standing guard when they're approached by one of the sergeants. And Jeremiah has drifted off to sleep. And when the sergeant wakes him, he explains that he's been on guard since dawn. The sergeant replies, "So is this soldier," referring to Robert, to Deborah. Right. And he says, "And you don't see him complaining because that soldier is a man." And that last sentence stays with Deborah from there on. How does she internalize that phrase, "that soldier is a man"?
I think she takes it as affirmation in two ways. I think she takes it as affirmation as she's passing and she's able to carry on this masquerade, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. But I think in a larger and perhaps more important sense, she takes it as affirmation that she's doing her job well. And when I think of Deborah, I think of her less as a person who desperately wanted to be a man and much more as a person who desperately wanted to belong. I think that she was outside of her cultural mainstream in mm-hmm. Middleborough. She was an independent woman. People probably didn't like her for being so free-spirited and independent. And in the army, she was able to be herself, in a sense, of course, by not being herself. But she was able to succeed and to belong. And hearing that soldier's a man, she was told, "You're doing well."
Hmm. You must think about this, obviously, as someone who was born a woman and became a transgendered person. If she had lived today, would she have taken that route, do you think?
I doubt it. I think that what she wanted was freedom that wasn't allowed to women. I think she wanted to be able to go from town to town, which women weren't allowed to do unescorted in her era. I think she wanted to have a job and support herself, which women really had a hard time doing unless they were widows and inherited their husband's business. But all of those freedoms are permitted to women these days. And I imagine that she would be more successful in living as a woman today.
I'd love you to tell me something about the research because, again, I want to keep stressing, I know you've written a novel, but you did a lot of historical research to really figure this out. What were the hardest parts about this story to come up with and figure out?
At first, the hardest part was reading Deborah's own recounting of the story, mm-hmm. which was written in an as-told-to biography in 1797, and cutting away the sort of fable, the untruths that Deborah told about herself, about her service, just kind of getting rid of that and figuring out what actually happened. Mm-hmm. And then after I'd done that, it was looking for the details that would make this real and not just sort of history on the page, but something that had a little bit of air and life in it. Going back and looking at letters and journals that soldiers, not Deborah, but other soldiers, just common, average soldiers wrote, so I could figure out what was their voice? What were they writing about? What did they care about? Reading newspaper articles and almanacs at the time and getting a sense of, again, what were people's worldviews? What were their concerns? It took a long time before I felt that I had a real handle on what that world was like.
Deborah was eventually found out by a doctor who took care of her when she came down with a severe fever. She ends up being honorably discharged in 1783. And she ended up marrying a man, having three children after the war. She lived out the rest of her life in Sharon, Massachusetts. Do you think she was fulfilled in the end?
No, I don't. I think that she had a very hard life after the war, in many ways as hard as her life before the war. I think the marriage was largely an unhappy one. She thought she was landing something of a catch with Benjamin Gannett, but he and didn't inherit the farmland she hoped he would. They had a very tough existence. Mm. Three children was very few for that age, and the rumor around town was that she had sort of cut him off. Mm. She was generous, however. She took in other children and had a couple of sort of foster children as she had been when she was a child. And their life was so penniless that she actually went on the road as a lecturer to make money for the family. Again, totally unheard of at the time. She was the first woman lecturer in America to travel around. And she had to fight to get her military pension. And then when she died, Benjamin Gannett had to fight to keep receiving that military pension. And her children had to fight to keep receiving that military pension. And she fought for every nickel she could get.
Wow. And do we know from the historical record how she actually fought in the war?
It is hard to tell. The records of West Point weren't meticulously maintained, but her unit, and she's on some muster rolls for her unit throughout the time that she says she served, was active in the Westchester rotation. So they went. We know they circled down to Sing Sing and Peekskill and Tarrytown, and we know there were skirmishes at that time. There's no actual record of the soldier Robert Shurtleff seeing action, but if we can assume that she was with her unit, and we can assume that she saw very minor skirmishes, some with cavalry, some with irregulars, probably some with just farmers who had muskets and didn't want any soldiers on their property.
Yeah. Now, you consider Deborah Sampson to be as influential as Abigail Adams, Martha Washington, Betsy Ross, and yet she's a relatively, compared to them, she's a more obscure historical figure. Why do you think that is?
Because she's poor. I mean, I think all of the women that you just named are high upper-class women. It's the same reason we know the founding fathers and we don't know the average soldiers or even the not-so-average soldiers.
Mm. What's your hope? What do you want readers to take away from this really extraordinary story about Deborah Sampson?
I hope that they think something about what the capacity of women to serve in the military and the capacity of women to do jobs that they have historically been told are only for men or only appropriate for men. But I also hope that the average reader comes to it with an open mind about gender and doesn't either assume that Deborah was or was not transgender, but let the sort of the story carry that gender identity along. And she shifts between pronouns. And just let that happen. Just think a little bit about what we believe about gender and why we believe those things. And I hope that it causes people who have never really thought about gender identity to give it some consideration.
Well, Alex Myers, it's a great read. Congratulations. A great story. And you've done a wonderful thing with a novel. So thank you for coming in and talking about it. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Alex Myers is author of Revolutionary, a novel based on the life of America's first female soldier, Deborah Sampson. We spoke with him this past January.
Well, coming up, you may know her as Big Boo from the hit Netflix series Orange is the New Black, but actress and comedian Leah Delaria tells us about her career in jazz. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Of all the memorable scenes in Netflix hit series Orange is the New Black, one of the most unforgettable belongs to actress Leah Delaria. Now, we won't be playing that scene for you because of its adult content, albeit its very funny adult content. Suffice it to say, a screwdriver is involved. Delaria plays butch lesbian Carrie Big Boo Black, one of the inmates at a federal women's prison.
Instead, we'll play this scene, in which Big Boo is talking with Pensatucky, an unhinged religious fanatic played by actress Taryn Manning.
Do you think you could help me?
Well, what's hurting?
My mind. I have unclean thoughts. Lesbian content. Mm. Since I had little Boo, I found these feelings of mothering deep inside me. I think someday I might want to have a kid. But I don't want to do it with another woman, because those kids, they always turn out gay. Mm. And being queer, that is a really hard life.
Mm-hmm. Orange is the New Black vaulted Delaria into stardom. But for more than 30 years, she's been an established Broadway performer, stand-up comedian, and talented jazz singer, as you hear in her rendition of Down with Love.
Set the brain down with love. Let's liquidate all its friends. Moon and June, roses and rainbows.
We caught up with Leah Delaria back in February. Season 2 of Orange is the New Black premieres on June 6th, so it seems a great time to revisit our conversation. And we covered a lot of ground, from Delaria's stand-up career to understanding what butch identity means to her, to what it was like being the first openly gay comic on late-night television. But we started with where her career started, as a singer, when she was just a little girl.
My dad is a jazz pianist, and I showed a propensity towards jazz when I was really young, and he was delighted by it. And he would play the piano, and I would sing with him. And then he just made me put on a little dress and took me with him and took me into the nightclub that he was working at in East St. Louis. And the next thing I know, I was on stage singing with the band.
Wow.
I was a circus act. You know what I mean? It was like, look at the – I was a clown. I was a, you know, like the bearded lady, anything like that. And he kept that up for years, pretty much till I hit puberty and my mom kind of put herself spread eagle in front of the door and said, you're not taking my teenage daughter into that nightclub with all those men. Of course, now she probably wishes she'd let me go. But
sorry, I probably shouldn't laugh at that because, I mean, it wasn't the easiest thing in the world for your parents to accept your sexuality.
No, because, you know, Catholic.
Yeah.
Italian Catholic. But honestly, everybody, I say this to all young people who are experiencing problems with their family. Eventually they come around, and eventually my parents came around.
Well, you grew up in Illinois, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me more about growing up. I mean, when did you know that maybe men weren't your cup of tea?
Are you seriously going to ask me when did I know I was gay?
I think I just did.
No, you totally asked me when did I know I was gay.
I mean, is that a dumb question?
No, it's not that it's dumb. It's just very, it just makes me wish for the old days when there weren't so many gays.
Well, here's why I asked.
When I stood out a little bit.
I mean, I didn't mean to be
I mean, every time I meet these kids and they talk about how they have, like, gay clubs in their high school, I think I had a gay club in my high school. It was called P.E.
Okay, so here's why I asked that question. Because if I remember correctly, in your early stand-up, for example, your childhood and your family and your Catholic upbringing and all the complexities that came along with, you know, being gay, that was a major part of your stand-up.
Absolutely. Back then, it was important for me to talk about those things because no one else was doing it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I made the absolute choice to always be who I am. Because when I looked around when I was a kid, there was nobody.
Yeah.
So I sort of wanted to be somebody. I wanted to be somebody out there for other people to see.
Well, how did you then get into stand-up? Because as you were just telling us earlier, like singing was part of your career from the time you were a kid. Why'd you take the turn into stand-up as well?
I guess my mother and father were always a big influence on me, and they always taught me to think for myself, say what I thought, that there were more important things to do in life than just pay bills. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So when I got to be very outspoken, I mean, the person that I am, the individual that I am, stand-up comedy was one of the, it was not even one of the, it was the biggest way to be able to put your voice out there and actually create change or a dialogue amongst people about something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was living in San Francisco, and San Francisco was one of the big heyday places. It was like the place where you would go and do stand-up.
Well, in that sort of like desire to have something to say and to change the world through what you were saying, is that what drove your... I mean, you've had this very sort of in-your-face, brash, comedic style from the start.
Right.
I mean, we were looking for a clip of your of a comedy act of yours to play... But we could not, because this is a family radio program. We can't even say, like, what you build your early career as. We'd have to bleep it all out.
You have to bleep it all out. Family people, just put my name into the search engine and then tell the kids to leave the room.
That's probably the best way to do it. But tell me, was being bold and in your face, was that just you from the start, or was that just also
that was always
way,
me.
That was the way you could also say what you wanted to say?
Please, you saw what name I used to perform under, so yeah,
yes.
That was always me. It was my style, and I was a lot brasher than a lot of people out there, and that was also a choice because I'm a woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a dyke. I'm fat. I have this image, and back in the 80s, women weren't allowed to use those words. You were a bad woman if you used those words. Let's call this spade a spade. You were a bad girl.
Yeah.
I'm making quotations with my fingers, but you can't see them. But you were a bad girl. And, you know, ladies don't spit and holler. Well, I was up there spitting and hollering and using that language and showing that as a woman, you could be anything you want to be.
Yeah.
Even the pottiest mouth in the room. Now, interestingly enough, when I was the first openly gay comic on television in America, it was on the Arsenio Hall Show.
1993,
and I used that word quite a bit.
Like 47 times, right?
47 times. Somebody counted. That's why I know that. But after the air was over, everybody disappeared. We were like, where is everybody? They were all in talking with the lawyer who was saying that they couldn't air me because I'd used those words.
Wow.
And it was Arsenio that put his foot down and finally said, if that is what she calls herself, then that is what she calls herself.
Well, tell us more about that appearance, because you really did break a barrier there by being the first openly gay comic on Late Night.
Yeah, it was scary and exciting and all of those things at once. I mean, you don't start off doing what it is that I did in the 80s and expect it to end up on American television. I certainly, the last 20 years of my career have all been a complete surprise to me. People who are as political as I am and as outspoken as I am, this stuff doesn't generally happen for them. So I couldn't be more thrilled. I'm tickled pink.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about your singing in just a minute, because that's such a huge part of your career. But let's stick with comedy for another second here, because I want to fast forward to your latest comedy show, which is called The Last Butch Standing.
Yes.
And so obviously there's a lot about butch identity here. Tell us a little bit about that show.
I have been kind of quietly singing and acting for the last few years and not doing a lot of stand-up. And one day I kind of looked around and did not like what I saw within my own community. And I felt that I just kind of said, wow, you have been neglecting stand-up, because somebody needs to be out there talking to people about this.
Well, when you say you did not like what you saw in your own community?
I don't like the way butches, I didn't like the way, for example, the way Butch Dykes were sort of pushed aside by the sort of mainstreaming of our community, the middle class mainstreaming assimilationists, sort of wannabe quote unquote gays and lesbians that are out there.
Uh-huh.
They think of us as sort of a dirty word or a dirty name. That offends me. I have issues with that. So I'm speaking out about that a lot.
Yeah.
Well, pretty much everywhere I go.
How would you describe what butch identity is then?
Butch identity is a very old school and important, I think, part of our culture. I mean, the reality is butches, we've always been around. You know, they've had a variety of expressions for us throughout the ages. And my favorite being mannish. I love mannish. Mannish just makes me giggle every time I hear it. But what I find is, as we as a community start to get the things that we have been fighting for so long, that we're able to get married, that we're able to have children, that we're able to just openly be a family and who we are, as we get those things, more and more we become complacent and find ourselves losing our own identity. And in search of being a part of the quote-unquote norm of the world. And I think that whenever any organization, group, community, or individual forgets their history, they're in trouble.
Well, I'm talking with Leah Delaria. She is, you probably know her as Carrie Big Boo Black from the hit Netflix series Orange is the New Black, but she has had a long and fabulous career as a singer and a stand-up comedian and an actress as well. We haven't talked that much about your singing except for those early days, and we mm-hmm. must, because your voice is truly amazing. So you made your Broadway debut in the revival of On the Town in 1998, and we've got a clip here of you singing a big song from that, I Can Cook Too, and this is a Carnegie Hall performance in 1999.
Well, I can cook too, on top of seafood's the best in the town. Yeah, I can cook too. My fish can't be beat. My sugar's the sweetest around. I'm a man's ideal of a perfect meal, right down to the dummy task. I'm a pot of joy for a hungry bud, baby. I'm cooking with gas. Oh, I'm a gun.
It's fabulous. It's fabulous.
I haven't heard that in ages. That sounded pretty good.
It sounds like Broadway was a long-time dream for you and then turned into a dream come true.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think people are really surprised by how much I know about Broadway, because I've just always been a huge fan. I mean, inside this big Bull Dyke body beats the heart of a vicious queen, trust me. I love musicals. So when that dream came true for me, that Broadway dream of being downstage center. And I didn't stop the show 8 times a week, but I certainly slowed it down. And that was a really, really exciting thing for me.
Well, speaking of your love of musicals, we've got you and a rendition of All That Jazz from Chicago.
Oh, I'm gonna see my Shiva Shimmy Shake.
About jazz that you love so much, because clearly your voice has got the power and versatility to go in any direction you'd want it to go.
A couple of things. One, it's America's one true art form. It originated here. It's our identity as Americans. I love that you create it then, right as you're standing there, it's created, that there's 4, 5, 6, 7, however many musicians all speaking to each other in a language that they all understand, and it's all happening before your eyes. And when that moment happens, it's gone, and you'll never get it again. That's why I love jazz.
And you love it so much that you put out an album called Double Standards. You did covers of Green Day, Blondie, No Doubt, but in a jazz style.
Oh my God, we had such a list of songs for that. Green Day, there's Patti Smith, there's Robert Wyatt, there's all sorts of crazy stuff on it. My personal favorite on that particular record has to be Neil Young's Philadelphia. I do love that.
Someone is talking to me, calling my name, tell me I'm not to blame. I won't be ashamed of.
Now, I can imagine that folks listening to this about this point in time are yelling at their radios and saying, we love her stand-up, we love her singing, but you've got to talk about the show.
Orange is the New Black, Orange is the New Black.
All right, so yes. You play Carrie Big Boo Black on the show.
Her.
And let's start off our conversation about it with a clip. This is a scene where Big Boo is playing a trick on Pensatucky. Played by Taryn Manning. It's a great scene. And Pensatucky.
Taryn is so great in this scene. Everybody talks about me, but personally, Taryn is so great in this scene.
Pensatucky believes that, of course, homosexuality is a sin. So your character, Big Boo, is asking Pensatucky to pray the gay out of her.
As I lay my hand on this child's head right here, right now, I ask you, Lord, help her. Help her become Gaylord, no more!
I don't feel any different. Wait, let me try picturing the 2008 U.S. women's soccer team. That usually works. Okay. Kick it, kick it. Wait. Wait, I don't feel anything. I don't feel anything.
It worked.
I don't like this. Take me back. No, no. Don't leave me here like this. No, don't leave me straight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take me back!
Well, you've got to tell the story about how you got the role of Big Boo, because it wasn't the way you expected.
They had me reading for the part that Kathy Curtin plays, one of the COs, and got a call from my manager saying they actually love you, but they want you to come in person, and they want to give you a different role. This isn't the right role for you. They feel they want another type in it. So I was like, okay. So I went in, and I read for the part that eventually was given to Lynn Tucci. Anita DeMarco is the role.
Right.
So I go to my manager's office, and he's on the phone with casting as I walk in, and it didn't sound good. And he hung up the phone, and he said, they think that you're not old enough. I think people are always surprised when they find out I'm 55 years old, because I just don't look it.
No. Sorry, that just took me aback, too. You don't look it at all.
I know. And I was screaming, just yelling at my manager. And I remember distinctly saying, if they are writing a show that takes place in a women's prison and there isn't a part for me, I quit. I quit. I'm done with this industry. I'm done with this business. If you need me, I'm in Europe singing. And when I got off the plane, my phone machine was filled with messages from my manager going, see, you had your little hissy fit and now you have to come back because they really did find a part for you.
They essentially wrote it for you, right?
They wrote it for me. It was originally a part that was only in a couple of episodes. As each episode happened, Carrie's part got bigger and bigger. It was really exciting for me.
Wow. Well, what was it like to work with a cast of basically all women? I mean, there aren't many shows that are like that.
I know. I'm sitting here. I'm just rocking back and forth because I don't want to interrupt you. You know what I mean? Because it's so exciting to be doing it that whenever anybody asks me that question, I get really excited. Magna, you never see it. You never see it. To be involved with all these creative women. And, you know, this is my entire life. I've been doing this. This is my life's mission, mm-hmm. right? So here I am working with a bunch of other people who that's been their life's mission too. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not only are we doing this thing that's going out on the airwaves, but people are actually being tricked. I mean, I think you're probably 4 or 5 episodes in before you realize how feminist the show is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite things about it.
You know, we were talking about your breakthrough on Arsenio and uh-huh. your early stand-up when, you know, nobody or almost nobody was talking about being out. And now, you know, fast forward these 30 years and there's this smash hit on Netflix that has these very sort of nuanced and textured and humane and real characters. You know, so many of whom are either gay or, I mean, there's a great transgender character as well. I mean,
Laverne.
That's a huge sea change in terms of just what you've seen in your own career.
It's a big, big change. And I have to tell you, like the way I feel about this in the same way that I feel about gays getting married, never thought I'd see it in my lifetime. Either one of those things. So for me to see this in my lifetime and also think that I may have had something to do with it, it's so exciting.
Season 2 launches in June.
June 6th,
June
yes.
June 6th. Can you tell us anything?
Yes, I can tell you that I'm in it.
Anything
that
more?
Is, Laverne's in it.
Okay. I'm
Kate
waiting.
Kate Mulger's in it. Natasha Lyonne is in it. These are the things I can tell you. It was created by Jen G. Cohen. Oh, it'll be airing on Netflix. And you know what? I can tell you one thing. I don't think anyone's going to be disappointed. It's great.
Leah Delaria is a stand-up comedian, singer, actress. She plays Carrie Big Boo Black on Orange is the New Black. Leah, it has been an absolute delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Magna, you call me anytime. It's a delight to speak to you as well.
Want, love, won't borrow. Today, tomorrow, your love is my love. Love.
We spoke with actress, comedian, and singer Leah Delaria back in February. And we'll go out now with her rendition of Love Me or Leave Me.
And stay with us, because coming up, another great voice in jazz. Madeline Peyrou pays homage to the great Ray Charles on her latest album, The Blue Room. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Getting someone new. I want no one unless it's you. I intend to be independently blue. I want your love. I don't want to borrow. Have it today to give it back tomorrow. Your love is
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Jazz singer Madeline Peyrou is famous for channeling Billie Holiday's vocal style. And you can hear it on her latest album called The Blue Room.
Take these chains from my heart and set me free.
It's an homage to the great Ray Charles, specifically to his classic album Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music. When it came out in 1962, Charles had embraced a mix of R&B, gospel, soul, jazz, and country. He could do it all. Among the songs he covered was the Hank Williams tune Take These Chains From My Heart. Here's Madeline Peyrou's take on that song from her new album.
Take these tears from my eyes and let me see just a spark of the love that used to be.
Madeline Peyrou joined us last October with her guitar to sing and talk about Ray Charles and the idea behind her new album, The Blue Room, which she says came from her producer, Larry Klein.
Larry's idea to pay homage to modern sounds in country and western music was so obvious that it became brilliant for me as an idea when he said, you know, well, this is so influential. This is the kind of music that we always go back and listen to. I didn't think that it was something I could carry, and I suggested that he get somebody else to do the record. But I suggested perhaps he needed to maybe think of putting together a bunch of people to do something like this. But what I found interesting was that for him, that was kind of the opposite of what he was thinking. So it was more about to really get personal, pay close attention just to the one voice and to the certain attitude that we could create together, he and I.
Let me ask you about Ray Charles and how familiar you were with his repertoire before this project. You're both from Georgia, I know that, but I'm just wondering what kind of influence did he have on you?
I can remember just listening to some of these songs that we played on this record over and over, just thinking, wow, does anybody realize how amazing this is? You know, he's exciting to listen to, and he's a lot of fun to listen to. But also, I think if you want to learn about music, there's a whole world that just opens up completely. I mean, he takes the slowest tempos of anybody in pop music. His ability to be minimalistic and yet super exciting in terms of groundbreaking R&B type renditions of tunes.
Well, I say love, oh, love, can it love? I say love, oh, love, oh, can it love?
So I think he mixed up a lot of things for a lot of different styles of music. I didn't really hear a lot of other people talking about Ray Charles in a jazz context until much later, so you had to search a little, you had to dig deeper, I think, to get into a more serious attitude towards him. And I used to be a little bit angry about that, that a lot of people don't recognize him for really being who he is in terms of American legacy.
I once was blind, but now I see.
He was such a great storyteller, and when I think of your stuff and your performance style, I think of powerful storytelling as well.
Well, I think of storytelling as being part of the human voice, the nuances, the things that you can hear in the voice and how they can make you imagine all of the stuff that might not be said in words. And I like the fact that Ray was not just all the other things that he was, but he was actually a really wonderful singer.
That old love has made a fool of me.
I think that he makes it sound easy. And just like I think everybody that's really influenced me in trying to learn to play music, it's the people that make it sound easy. You can learn from, because for one, it just gives you a little bit of encouragement.
So. Sure. Well, let's hear another song, Madeline.
Okay.
What are you going to do for us?
I'd like to play my favorite, I Can't Stop Loving You.
Stop loving you. I've made up my mind to live in memories of that lonely it's useless to say. So I'll just live my life in dreams of yesterdays. Those happy hours that we once knew. They still make me blue. They say that time heals a broken heart, but time has stood still since we've been apart. Wanting you, I made up my mind to live in memories of a lonesome kind. I can't stop wanting you. It's useless to say, so I'll just live my life in dreams of yesterday.
Madeline Peyrou performing I Can't Stop Loving You. It's among the songs on her new album, The Blue Room. Madeline, thank you for that. That was just beautiful. You called it your favorite song. Why? What do you love about that song?
Perhaps it's probably the most challenging one for me to have tried to do after having heard Ray Charles's version for so long. I think that version of that song is so political. You know, I love it because I feel that it's so political in the right ways, in the perfect ways.
I'm not sure I understand that. I'd love you to explain that more.
Okay, good. I deserve that. The arrangement that he used, and I believe both the musical effects that it had and also, I think, sort of the American identity that was, I think, infused into the arrangement by coupling a completely different sound, a very sort of traditional, almost like Hollywood, Broadway type of I can't stop loving you, I've made up my mind, with the call and response and the fact that there's a duality to the emotion that comes through.
I said I made up my mind to live in memories of the lonesome time. Sing a song, children.
Sincere, it's charmingly kitsch, you know, it's corny and it's beautiful, and so it makes you forgive any of the lack of soul that was in the white version, and it makes you forgive any of the bitterness that's in sort of the black version, if it's okay for me to say it that way.
Now I understand what you meant by.
Okay.
Thank
you.
So
well, I could use your help anytime.
No, you did that. You did that all on your own. So The Blue Room, it's not just a collection of Ray Charles songs. It also includes material from Hank Williams, Buddy Holly, Leonard Cohen, among others. Why did you want to include their material as well?
I think the goal was to try to find stuff that would follow in suit in the same spirit of what he was doing. So trying to explore what it is to be modern and to continue exploring this idea of mixing American styles.
I've always been impressed with the songs you choose to cover. And I mean, I'm thinking even back to your Careless Love album. You did a wonderful version of the Leonard Cohen song, Dance Me to the End of Love.
Dance me to your beauty with a burning violin. dance me through the panic till I'm gathered safely in. Lift me like an olive branch and be my homeward dove. Dance me to the end of love.
How do you go about choosing what to cover? Because once you start focusing on Leonard Cohen or Bob Dylan or Randy Newman, there are just so many amazing songs. I'm just curious about how you choose that one.
Yeah, absolutely. To tell you the truth, when I was trying to recall how I came up with Dance Me to the End of Love, somebody asked me recently, and I remembered that Larry Klein sent me home with, I think, a book full of Leonard Cohen lyrics and said, you know, go and learn some of these. So I did learn quite a few of them and tried playing them. So it was just trial and error. And so Dance Me to the End of Love was natural.
Dance me to the wedding now, dance me on and on.
The only way to really pick songs is to be lucky enough to have people that can help you filter. That's what I think.
Let me ask you about your songwriting, because for a lot of your career, you've covered other people's songs. Now the Blue Room is entirely covers again. Do you prefer performing other people's music over writing your own?
I prefer to sing great songs, you know, and that's why it's really very difficult to be a songwriter for me. You know, I don't know what to think about my own songwriting at this point, but I love writing, and it's probably the craziest part of me that keeps trying, because it's always really, really difficult, and it's always a shot in the dark. So
I came across a quote from the 2009 documentary Something Grand, which traces your career, and you ask at what point, what would it be like if I only sang my own material? I can't imagine it.
Yeah, that would be kind of terrible, wouldn't it? Like, if everybody was that way, we'd all be really selfish people. And then I think the other truth is that I think that it's really great to have somebody else sing a song, no matter who, that they didn't write, so that you can get a different attitude towards that song.
Yeah. Well, Madeline Perry, it was always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
And it's a great pleasure to hear you sing. And I'm wondering if you can just play us out on one more song.
I'd love to. I thought I'd do the Buddy Holly tune.
Changing All Those Changes.
Right.
Fantastic.
Sweetheart, I'm changing.
Madeline Peyrou, singing and speaking to us last October. Her latest album is called The Blue Room. There's more information at radioboston.org, where you can find a web extra of her performing the Hank Williams tune, Take These Chains From My Heart.
But to change up all those changes that I made when I left you. To change up all those changes that I made when I left you. Just left without a care. Now I know I'm wrong, but I can't find you anywhere. Well, I should have reconsidered all those things I said I'd do. But I'm changing all those changes that I made when I left you. I'm changing all those changes that I made when I left you, sweetheart.
And that's it for this Memorial Day. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Our program is produced by Amory Sievertson, Dina Rosendorf, Alex Kingsbury, Emma Jean Weinstein, and Kathleen McNerney, with help from Jamie Bologna.
Tim Skoog is our technical director. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We hope you're enjoying a great holiday, and will join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
And there's nothing I can do to change up all those changes that I made when I left you. I'm changing all those changes that I made when I left you. Sweetheart, changing all those changes I'll be changing. I'm changing all those changes I am changing. Sweetheart, sweetheart.